WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're staying calm. We're completely local. I would feel a little better if we were doing this segment at Fadley's over a crab cake, maybe an adult beverage and some oysters this time of year, or over at our friends at State Fair where I could have some chicken and waffles or some shrimp and grits, or maybe just like a burger or a club sandwich or just an honest-to-God French fry that's been soaked in grease, which I haven't had in about 10 weeks. But we'll get over to State Fair, and they're going to be socially distancing over there. They're going to be opening up the Mexican restaurant across the street. Don Moeller will meet you at the front door whenever we can get 6 feet away, and maybe with a mask on as well, and give you a little tour of Frederick Road. We do appreciate all of our sponsors. You can order those crab cakes from Fadley's online. You can curbside or hang out over at State Fair. And by all means, and I know Don clicked the button and ordered some Taharka made in Baltimore. Incredible ice cream. I have consumed all the chocolate love here, but Don has a couple to this in the fridge as well. And let's not forget Moeller and Gary Realty and selling homes, listing homes. Tis the season for all of that. And, you know, I went to sell and list my home a couple years ago, couldn't sell it. And one of the things I did was reach to Don Moeller and said, we got to start this thing called Baltimore Positive. And you were the Baltimore County executive at the time, and we said we're going to do this thing talking about things in Baltimore, looking toward the election. And at that time, I guess we didn't know enough about this guy's reporting. And I know you have a lot of background with Luke Broadwater as he leaves Baltimore to move on and Pulitzer and all that stuff, and my background and starting and joining the Baltimore Washington Newspaper Guild as a 17-year-old back in 1986. Don, this is going to be a fun one with Luke Broadwater, huh?
Well, Luke has interviewed me once or twice along the way. I've never interviewed him, so it's a pleasure. Also, Nets, you may not know this, but another Catonsville guy.
Look out the comments. Here we go.
No. McDonough boy, right, Luke?
That's right, yep. Catonsville Elementary School, and then I got a scholarship to McDonough for middle and high school. But
there you go.
You were the one that got the scholarship. I screwed that up back in 79. They took me out to McDonough, and they said, back to Dundalk with you. But, hey, I still made my way to Calvert Street, man. First off, I just, as a journalist and as someone that's done this and as someone who was in that newsroom with a lot of the people that recruited you and brought you along, and I know your background at the Examiner and whatnot, kudos on everything. And, you know, you're about to move to another place in your life. I hope you're not like me, face down at Burke's, drinking beer and crying because I was leaving the Sun in 1992, because that's how I left, you know?
Well, first, I'm obviously really honored and excited and actually extremely nervous to go cover Congress for the New York Times. It's a big opportunity, but it's also a huge responsibility. Leaving the newsroom at the Sun at this time is a little bit surreal. I was there on election night till 3 in the morning, covering the results as they came in. Or
what results?
Come in. And it was just me and two other people in a, you know, socially distanced newsroom wearing masks, and so I carried a box of my stuff out.
Luke, I know you've only been there 10 years. Can I give you a little, as a kid? Sure. I was there in 1986, 88, 90, 92, so a couple of presidentials and what, you know, back in the Reagan, you know, going before Clinton got there, but in that period. And I was telling Don, I guess maybe with Ben Jels, maybe we were talking about the election. It was surreal to be an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid because it literally was an all-hands-on-deck experience putting the newspaper out in the 1980s and 90s on election night when you're chasing dot, double dot, triple dot, chasers, finals, updates, all of that they had so much food. All I can remember is that, you know, they would bring in pizza. And it was the one night every 2 years, or actually we had two a year, right, where you got fed. And so you're saying it's a little different in 2020 than it was in 1988, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you know, election night pizza is a great newsroom tradition. This year, with only two other people there, my editor brought in Samos, some chicken pita from the Greek spot in town. So that was nice, but it was not the 18 or 20 pizzas or whatever they usually get.
Well, Luke, for those of you just joining us, we have Luke Broadwater, Baltimore Sun columnist, on his way, or Baltimore Sun reporter, on his way to the New York Times. And for those of you who are only casual newspaper readers, we encourage you to read more often. We're going to talk a little bit as well today on the effort to save the Sun. But I think it's safe to say, although it was a team effort, Luke is the reporter responsible for the Sun's recent Pulitzer Prize and the uncovering of the Healthy Holly scandal. So, Lou, first of all, on behalf of all of us who love newspapers, congratulations for that effort and for that. There is no bigger award, I guess, right, than the Pulitzer.
Yeah, thank you. It was, it was sort of a humbling day for the Sun, but a great day of excitement. As I'm sure we'll talk about later, the Sun has shrunk tremendously over the years from, I believe, 450 journalists to less than 90. And it had been 17 years since we had won a Pulitzer Prize and 13 years since we won a Polk Award. So for us to do it this year, even with the much diminished staff and much greater pressures on journalists today, was really a boost to the newsroom, let people know. Well, it's just a big honor when you hear the Pulitzer judges look at the work around the country and see all the submissions, hundreds of submissions, and say this is the best journalism in the country. That's obviously a huge honor, and it's in some ways, if people have been acting like the Orioles won a World Series or
sure.
the Ravens, like, it's been like that. It's been the city, like the emails I've been getting from readers. There's a sense of civic pride in the Sun.
Well, hold on, taking down an elected official who was this brazenly corrupt, right? Like, I mean, it is all the president's men on the local, I mean, going back to Agnew or anybody else that was corrupt here, you know, through the generations. But, man, you grew up into this and on the news side. I was always in the toy department, Luke. I was just trying to get the third-rate prize for the APSE, you know, best high school writer in 1988 or something. You know, the Pulitzer, it's above and beyond, but it really does speak to how she could still be the mayor. You know what I mean? Like, she could be the mayor getting reelected today, maybe if they would have counted the votes. I mean, I don't know how this happens from a deep throat or a tipster or whatever, but a lot of people were in on the Catherine Pugh thing, and I would think that there was smoke in the air for a hardcore reporter like yourself, that this wasn't something you heard on Monday and busted on Tuesday, you know?
Well, let's start with that, Nestor. Luke, I think that's a great question that people might have. When you started, which is where Nestor's question takes us, when you started to write about these donations of these books and to these books, did you have any sense on day one that you were onto something that was going to get bigger and bigger?
Maybe yes and no. So I can sort of tell the story about how everything came about. I was at the movies with my kids. I actually forget which movie it was. It was like a Sunday afternoon, and I had a missed call from State Senator Jill Carter, and I texted her back afterwards, and she said, "Hey, I have this minority contractor in my district who's trying to get work with the medical system and can't get any work. And so I've been asking them questions, and I can't get any documents out of them about where contracts are going, if things are bid out, if things are done above board. I just don't know. And you're good at digging into things. You're good at investigating things. Can you look into it?" And, you know, it was sort of a suggestion, like an idea. And I said,
Does that happen often, by the way, in your beat?
All the time.
Okay.
All the time.
You always say, email me tips. You know, I mean, everybody would say that,
absolutely.
Right? Literally.
And most tips don't pan out. Like most.
Oh, my God. Things. I did sports radio for 30 years. You know how many times people would call and say they saw John Elway walking through the airport and he must be coming here or whatever? I mean, you know, it's crazy, especially in the modern era, how phone booth could be played on anything like that, right?
So you get this text from Jill Carter, and you're coming home from the movies, and take this from there.
Yeah, so I often try to just go in the front door. You know, I don't. So I did that. I asked the medical system if they would provide me with their records of what contracts had gone out, whether they were bid or no bid, and I had been looking at the board members, and I knew certain board members had, you know, it seemed to me had some sort of work with the system. So I asked about board members as well, and they basically told me to pound sand, and so that made me want the records even more. And
right.
So I started calling around to different people.
No comment means make some more phone calls.
Absolutely, yeah. I like to say it like it tingled my spidey sense as a reporter that you think, well, why won't they give me the records? So if everything was above board, why wouldn't you just hand them over? So. So I called people. At this point, I didn't know that much about the medical system or how it worked or its contracting practices. And so I called a few people in the know who watched this kind of stuff. And they said, hey, look, you can't, they don't have to do them to you because they're technically a quasi-private corporation now. They've been privatized. It started as a public hospital, but it's now a private corporation. But they do have an oversight board. And they have to submit some forms to them, so maybe you can get them from them. So I called up there, and they said, oh, no one ever looks at those records. Like, no one ever asked for them. So let's dig them out for you. And so I put in the Public Information Act request and got all the documents, and I'm flipping through them, and I see some contracts that might be legit, might not be, I don't know. And then I saw Mayor Pugh was in there. And I saw they had paid her hundreds of thousands of dollars for her Healthy Holly books. And I had seen these books during the campaign, and it just struck me as odd that they were buying them in the same volumes as Harry Potter sold. So I was, I called a couple of people and I said, does this seem off to you? And they're like, yes, that's very strange. That's highly unusual. And that's how things got going. I didn't know it would necessarily spiral the way it did at the time. You sort of just, you know, as a reporter, you run down tips and you check them out and you write what you know and don't write what you don't know. And then the chips sort of fall where they may.
Well, what did you start to know, I guess, at that point, other than you see this? When is that, by the way? When is that Sunday you're with your kids? You know, like, and from that moment till the time where the FBI showed up at her front door?
So it was actually pretty quick. I mean, you know, from the time the first story published, it was 6 weeks later till she resigned. One thing that happened was she started telling stories that weren't true. So she would say, oh, I only made this much profit off it. It'd be some small number. But then you would get another document that showed she made hundreds of thousands more than that. Or she would say, oh, I only had this one deal with this one system. And then it turned out, oh, basically multiple contractors that went before the Board of Estimates and one of these contracts were told they had to buy these books. And so it was, you know, not just one contractor, but now it's 8 or 10. And now there's some donor who she asked to pay $100,000 for the books, and she only gave him one book.
It's so brazen, isn't it? I mean, the way you talk about it, it just sounds like a mafia deal. I mean, to me, I mean, it just sounds like you're going to get in bed with, and these people are never going to rat you out, you know, because you're the mayor. It feels to me as a citizen, as a taxpayer down at the harbor that I can't get anybody to walk through my place, which is why I started Baltimore Positive, in sort of the outrage of this, because as you're getting this information, are you not sort of a little outraged, even as a citizen, the reporter aside, to say, wow, this is so outrageous, I can't believe it's going on?
Well, I mean, so you sort of have to, as a journalist, you have to approach things with different hats on, right? So you can't get too emotional when you report, I don't think, because you have to play different roles in the story. So it's important to, in some cases, when you're doing investigative reporting, you are acting like a prosecutor or a judge. You are uncovering information and pointing out through analysis that this seems suspicious or unusual or whatever. But at the same time, you have to be the defense attorney, too. And so you have to put her best defense forward, and you have to give her attorney his best argument, and you have to be fair-minded. So you let your instincts sort of guide the story, from sort of the investigative reporting arm, but you can't get too outraged personally because you have to be fair throughout the whole piece. And you have to, I mean, ideally, even when you do investigative reporting, even the people who are on the other end of the investigation should feel that they were treated fairly. And that's, you have to keep that the whole time.
Well, Luke, typically, in my experience, you know, whether it's you or Pam or any of the many reporters that have covered Baltimore County, you know, if there was an issue that you were looking into that required more than just a quick phone conversation, you know, you'd request some time, and you would come out and you'd sit with Kevin, or you'd sit with Mayor, you'd sit with Jim Smith. Did you ever get the opportunity to sit with Mayor Pugh and walk through this, or was she accessible to you?
So the interviews I had with Mayor Pugh were contained mainly to the first week of it. I think after that her lawyers got involved, and it was from that point on we really only talked to the lawyers by their request. The very first story, I interviewed her in person in the courtyard at the State House. So she had been down there in Annapolis. She was going to testify on the Kerwin legislation. And I had really just gotten these documents only hours earlier. And so I saw her there, and I said, no better time to seize the moment, right? Like, why go through a spokesperson when you have the principal right there? So I walked up to her, and I said, I have to talk with you about your sale of these Healthy Holly books. And normally, Mayor Pugh would get cross with me when I would challenge her on things and tell me I had it all wrong, Leaky screwed it up again, that kind of thing. But this time she just seemed kind of worried. I saw like a little nervousness in her eyes. And
you knew her well enough to know her well enough,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure. I'd covered her for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, and we always had a, you know, good working relationship. Like, I think that she respected me as a fair person and you know, knew I wasn't somebody who just writes hit pieces and that kind of thing. And so then after the story published that night, she called me maybe 3 or 4 times and offered different versions of the story that kept changing. And I thought, this is not
like
good.
Your kid does when they did something wrong, literally, right?
I thought, this is not good. Yeah. So, and then, I mean, her spokesman then sent me, I think, an email at like 1:30 in the morning trying to clarify things. But at that point, even that email would be proved to be full of falsities by the next couple of days. So it was, you know, I do think in retrospect, like, they could have handled it differently. I'm not sure if it would have changed anything, but if she had gone to her people and laid out everything and they came forward at one time with one statement that was the truth, or as best you could tell it, and this is what I did, this is why I did it, this is why I'm sorry, maybe that would have changed things, I don't know, but it would have been at least different from like a communications perspective where you didn't have changing stories that kept being proven false over a period of weeks.
Well, look, then it evolved, and I guess, and you're the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist here, that you can lay it out. I guess this is not unusual for a big, complex story. It then evolved into a story about the role of corporate boards, right? It went just from the selling of these books to a larger story about the role that corporate boards play in the city of Baltimore.
Yeah, I mean, and so, you know, one thing you did see out of this was you saw reform, pretty quick reform. You saw legislation passed very fast in Annapolis that outlawed no bid contracting. So it said even these private, you know, quasi-private boards that do, I mean, these are formerly a public hospital that receives a lot of state money still, and its board members are appointed by the governor. So it does. There is a public role to it. But it said no longer can they do no-bid contracting with board members. So, and I think that's an important reform because it takes away the incentive to sort of look around the room at a board meeting and say, hey, who wants, you know, oh, you're going to vote this way, Senator? Well, sure, we'll buy your books or whatever may go on. And instead, now everything's got to go through a fair process where multiple, if they really wanted to buy hundreds of thousands of children's books as a hospital network, they'd put it out for bid. You would solicit from all the children's authors in town and see who had the best books, and that would be a more fair process. So, you know, it did prompt quick reform that could, you know, hopefully cut down on this type of thing happening in the future.
Luke Broadwater is our guest on Baltimore Positive. You know, a lifer Baltimorean going off to cover Congress for the for the Times, and you can find him at Luke Broadwater at on Twitter as well. For you, on the background of journalism and being a Baltimore guy and a Maryland guy, and I guess going down the road now and getting this gig. As when I was at the Sun, all I ever did was mail out cover letters and resumes, trying to get jobs at newspapers all over the place. The entire industry is under attack. Let's starting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. We're seeing people get pushed around and stuff. This notion that you would leave the Sun, I don't know that was that ever in your mind? I mean, you've been around here a long time, running off to the New York Times. Maybe that was a dream as well as a Pulitzer and all that, but probably in the middle of day-to-day reporting over the last 10 years, you weren't ever looking to leave here, right?
Well, I've always thought you should be the best, or at least among the best, or try to be the best at the job you have before you go looking for the next one. And so I was for years, I was constantly focused on just covering the City Hall the best I could, and then covering the State House as best I could. I will say that, you know, the current state of things with the Tribune Company had, maybe a few years back, planted the seed in my mind that if an opportunity would come along, I would be more likely to take it. When you saw just colleague after colleague leaving and their jobs not being filled, and then just recently with pay cuts and furloughs, you know, Tribune has made it a less attractive place to stay for your whole career. I'm not going to say that didn't play an influence, because it did. At the same time, you know, I mean, covering Congress for the New York Times is in many ways a dream job, and hard to pass up when it's offered. So I'm super excited and really honored for that. And honestly, you know, I don't want to sound I'm not, but it did matter to me that I will likely save somebody's job at the Sun, probably a younger reporter's job, by leaving.
Well, that's, you know, Luke, I want to talk about both those things. I want to talk about the Times and what that means in terms of the beat. And I guess we'll be seeing you all over cable news, sitting with Joe Scarborough and Nicole Wallace and Chris Cuomo. Your parents will be making all the tapes. But before we get there, because some people might not be following it closely as those of us who are news junkies. But I've been very clear publicly whenever I've been interviewed, I've been clear on social media, that I think what the Tribune is doing to the Sun is absolutely horrific. And I don't think people understand what danger the Sun is in. Nestor and I have been very supportive of the Save the Sun efforts. We've talked to Matt Gallagher about it. We've talked to Ted Benatolis. We talked to Damian O'Doherty.
Dan Rodericks. Don't forget Dan.
We talked to Dan. We've talked to Alaska about the importance of the Sun. And those of us who love newspapers know how important it is to save the Sun. But give folks, take the curtain back a little bit for them, Luke, and tell them really how the Trib has been taking the Sun apart piece by piece.
Yeah, so unfortunately, with the sale of the Sun to the Tribune Company, there has just been a tremendous downsizing of it and a contraction of it. The Sun closed up its farm bureaus some time ago. I mean, many people said it wasn't even that long ago that we had farm bureaus in London and Johannesburg and Jerusalem and Moscow. All over the world, those all closed.
I used to have to take dictation from those guys back in the 80s when their TRS-80 broke, you know?
Right.
True.
Yeah, exactly. We used to have a robust Washington Bureau. I was watching, you know, we had Sun reporters cover the White House and cover Congress, and we still do have one reporter in Washington. But I was watching some of the old debates and presidential debates, and Sun reporters would be panelists for the presidential debates between, you know, Kennedy and whoever, some of these, and obviously that's no longer the case. We used to break stories on the Pentagon and things like that. That's all been scaled back. So the papers just kept contracting and contracting, and then bought up, the local papers, and those have all been contracted as well. Closed down City Paper, closed down some of the other community papers. Some of the community papers only have maybe one or two reporters left. Basically, things that used to be covered aren't covered anymore. I started, my first full-time job in news was covering the school board for the Howard County Times. And I sat there till 2 a.m. covering school board meetings. And, that's how I sort of learned how to be a news reporter, was watching how government works really close up. And I just worry that that stuff is not being covered anymore. And so people, the public is less informed about what the government is doing. And I think that's a worse thing, because for everybody.
Well, look who got elected president.
Yeah.
So Luke, when you head down there to Congress now, just logistics, I'm sure you're, I know how we are as parents. I'm sure your mom and dad, but what does this mean in terms of where you live? Now you work for the New York Times, you're covering Congress. Does that mean you have to uproot your family? Can you work from where you live now, or what happens to Luke Broadwater's lifestyle now?
Well, we're figuring that out. I have two kids, and so, well, one, you can work in Washington from Baltimore. You can take 295 down, or you can take the MART train down. There's a lot of people that do that.
Imagine if we build that maglev, huh?
That would really make it easy, yeah. So there's, there are quite a few of my colleagues who live in Baltimore and work for the New York Times in out of the D.C. Bureau. So that is a possibility. But I mean,
we got to get even. The Washington Post lets shine and live here, right? So,
right. Yeah. So, but realistically, I mean, if I have to be at things quickly and there are late night votes, I don't know what I'm going to do yet. We have to. Jen and I have to figure that out with the kids. So that's
how many folks cover Congress for the New York Times? Is it you, or is it a cast of you and a bunch of others?
So I'll be joining a team of four other reporters, so there'll be five of us. It may seem like, covering 500 and some people and all their staffers and seems like really daunting. That's so many senators and Congress people to keep up with. But if you divide it five ways, it starts to be a little bit more manageable. Pam and I cover the legislature in Annapolis with two people, and that's 188 people. So it might break down. If each person has sort of 90 to watch, it might be somewhat similar.
Yeah, it just depends how many Republicans you're going to wind up getting, I would think.
Right.
And they won't talk to you. But, Luke, you mentioned, and you and Pam have done such a terrific job down covering the General Assembly. Couple thoughts on that. Really, really two big thoughts. One, how did Annapolis change post the leadership of the two Mikes? Obviously the loss of Mike Bush, the illness of Mike Miller. And again, we've had Speaker Jones on, we've had President Ferguson. How was Annapolis different without the two Mikes in charge?
So, I mean, it certainly has a different feel. Mike Miller and Mike Bush were two, sort of legends of Maryland politics in their own way. I covered the session where Mike Bush died, and that was in the final days of the session, and that was, everyone was depressed. It was a very dark, feeling in the room. Actually, the last bill that was passed was his bill to reform, was the reform bill that came out of the Catherine Pugh and the UMS case. That was the last, and that passed unanimously after he died. So that was his sort of final stamp, was reform. Adrienne Jones, Speaker Jones, has a different style, but I think she's very well respected, and she's really put an emphasis on education and finishing the job with the Kerwin bill and with school construction. And she's respected by both parties too. So it's the Republicans respect her too because of her. She is an inclusive, fair-minded person. On the other side, Mike Miller's still there, and every now and then Mike Miller will stand up and and give a speech like he still runs the place and everybody listens. You know, he is one thing about Mike Miller that's very underrated. He always makes me laugh. He has a great sense of comedic timing.
Not everybody always understood that sense of humor, Luke.
No.
Don has told me if I ever get involved in politics, it'd not be so flippant. But if I'm there 50 years, maybe I'm allowed, right?
Luke will go on to tell you here. Mike is one of those rare elected officials that makes that flippancy work, right, Luke?
It's the strangest thing, because if Bill Ferguson said some of the stuff Mike Miller said, he would probably have to step down. But Mike Miller can say, I don't get it. It's just, it does. Because of who Mike Miller is, he speaks his mind very frankly and almost no spin at all. Just whatever comes to mind comes out. So now Senate President Ferguson, it's his first year in the job. Like Speaker Jones, he's very committed to education. A former school teacher himself, and so they've really been pushing to make sure that Maryland education is the best in the country. And he even somewhat amazingly brought along 7 Republicans to vote for the Kerwin bill this year, which I thought was
they love our children.
That is a remarkable accomplishment of leadership, though, right?
And he did that by adopting Republican amendments on the bill. So the Republicans said in the Senate, well, I don't know. What if there's a bad turndown in the economy? We should have a governor on the bottom that says if the economy gets too bad, it doesn't go into effect. And that had been rejected on the House side initially. And Ferguson said, you know what, we'll accept it if we can get some Republican votes. And there were a couple other amendments like that to alleviate Republican fiscal concerns about the bill that he accepted. And so once those were added in the Senate side, the House then accepted them too. And so he did some things to make it a bipartisan effort. And it ended up being a bipartisan vote, at least among some Republicans in the Senate.
Luke, I want to drill down into Baltimore here. And by the way, I see the Taharka in your freezer, and our sponsors appreciate that.
Yeah, that was the best purchase of the pandemic by far. I'm going to re-up that probably next week.
So. And by the way, the matcha green tea, very underrated if you don't have the matcha green tea. I want to ask this on a Baltimore side, because, I mean, we started Baltimore Positive, and I would ask you, like, is the state better run or is the city and things get done in Annapolis? I don't know that things ever get done in the city, bro. And I live here, and my frustration is boiling at 2 decades. And your reporting of this woman who we entrusted to be on the up and up after riots, after the city half burned down, after the lady before that was stealing gift cards and fur coats and Lord knows whatever else. And now, as I sit here, we're adding up the votes, and she's going to be running the city again probably, unless Brandon Scott has some last-minute surge here. And it may take him 2 weeks to figure it out. And Don and I have taken a deep dive into what it feels like to wake up in America after riots with a mask on in a pandemic that apparently isn't a pandemic anymore because no one's honoring it, and Texas guards all over the White House. But more than that, we still don't have a mayor here, and we're not even down with whether the election's on the up and up, and I think Zeke Cohen and everybody in the first would probably be with that. But the city is such a mess. I mean, it's a mess at every level in this election thing. While, you know, it has tentacles into the city, it'll get blamed on the city. If you live in the city, it's one more thing with my water bill, with the crime, with the pot, whatever it is, tax bill, all of that, because I'm included in that because I am a resident here. As you depart, and if I made you mayor tomorrow, and obviously the mayor's position is a very powerful position, as we've learned from Bill Henry and others and Joan Pratt and voting and city council presidents and how much power the mayor has. If you get the power, what's really wrong here? Like, wait, give me 3 or 4 or 5 things right off the top, police-wise, education-wise, leadership-wise, competence-wise, water bill-wise, that the next mayor, whether it's Sheila or somebody else, has to look at and say, this is a mess in the city.
Well, I think the fundamental problem, and there may be a number of ways to change this, but the fundamental problem is the city keeps losing population. And if you lose population, you have less of a tax base, which means you can't fund your schools as well, and you can't clean up your streets as easily, and you can't fix your pipes as well. and you can't fund all the things that government should be funding. And unfortunately, the city has lost population since World War II. There have been some years where population was flat or actually went up a little bit, and the last time that happened was under Mayor Dixon. So if Mayor Dixon is the next mayor and there is a silver lining, I know you're concerned about that, Nestor, and as are others.
I would say about 70% of the residents in the city are concerned about that. I mean, literally, like, she's going to have such a small percentage of real support. And I don't know how many people will pull the lever. I'm thinking twice all around, because I pulled the lever for Catherine Pugh last time, like 133,000 other people did. And based on your reporting, you know, it was a grave error, you know? I mean, and if I see her, I'll tell her that.
I thought Mayor O'Malley, Governor O'Malley, had an interesting quote in that Politico piece, which he said he supported Mayor Pugh last time, too. He was worried that Mayor Dixon would not be able to attract top talent to City Hall. But now he feels, he said, that less people would have lost their lives had he made a different choice. You know, I don't know. The murder rate went down under Mayor Dixon. Population went up. There was obviously the criminal case against her. But at least some large number of Baltimoreans, looks like 30% of the Democratic base, remember the good things about her more than the bad. And so take that for what you will. Can she repeat the success she had from a governing standpoint again? I don't know. But if population goes up, crime goes down, streets get cleaner, that's sort of the recipe for success.
Right. Well, we had Mark Steiner on last week, Luke, and he was analyzing the mayoral race at that time. And one of his comments was, and he said that he had known Sheila since they were both in their 20s, and he said that he really felt that Sheila Dixon was on her way to becoming not just a good mayor, but a great mayor when she got involved in the issues that took her down, the gift cards and the accepting gifts from contractors. But he said that if people just focus on what she was doing, which is hard to do because you have to weigh in the other issues as well, but that she was indeed on her way, in his mind, becoming a great mayor. And Nestor, you've been pretty open on that, and that we've interviewed Sheila three times, and you didn't expect to like her. While you're still disappointed and not happy with the action she took when she was mayor, you said you came away saying, yeah, I kind of like her.
Well, Luke, I mean, you speak to that. I mean, I just don't think she can be the face of the city and the brand of the city for all the above reasons of integrity, our reputation, The Wire, what happened with Catherine Pugh, Freddie Gray, corrupt police, all of these things that we have here. This is not a fresh start, certainly not from an integrity standpoint. And I know, because I read this ad on the front of your Twitter, you're big into transparency as a Pulitzer Prize winner. You know, you sort of demand transparency. In the case of Sheila, when you talk about hiring the best people, she's a laughing stock in the counties. Like, all over social media, this is the people who look down upon Baltimore and say, I'm never coming back to Baltimore. And what we need in Baltimore are these counties to start supporting the city. And Don and I went through it with the entertainment and the museums and the Orioles and the restaurants and Little Italy and festivals and all of that stuff. I don't know that people have confidence in Sheila Dixon. On the whole, have confidence in her. And I think there's going to be a pretty healthy level of outrage among the other 70% of us who do not want her to be mayor, but would have no problem if she was doing something educating people or doing something in economic. I mean, I think she's a good public servant and a good citizen, quite frankly. But I don't know she should be the face of Baltimore. I don't know that really helps Baltimore's issues globally.
Well, and you're making the case that I think Brandon Scott made, and also that, you know, obviously the Sun editorial board, which endorsed Brandon Scott, is that through our polling and other methods, interviewing voters and analyzing the vote, Brandon Scott probably had the best chance for unifying the city. He was supported equally among black and white residents. He crossed over, you know, with youth and also with older voters. That said, if Sheila Dixon ends up winning, I would hope that those people in the county would, she would have won with the votes almost entirely of middle and low income black people. And I would hope that they would at least have enough respect to say, I'm going to respect the choice of a wide swaths of Baltimore City and at least, you know, see if this can work. So, and not just, you know, and not just condemn the wide swaths of the electorate on who they think is the best choice for them.
Excellent point, Luke. It's been terrific. I know you have to run. Once again, congratulations. Kill the surprise. Congratulations, New York Times. Hey, real quick question for those of us who are moms and dads. How'd your parents react when you told them you won the Pulitzer?
Oh, I don't know. My mom started crying, and she said she wished my grandparents were alive.
Well, how do you find out? Can you tell me that? So give me that little story. Like, where are you when you find out? Because that really, that is special. That's unbelievable. Were you with your parents, with your wife, with your family?
No, I remember it's the pandemic, so, we couldn't, sadly, couldn't be with my parents. I haven't even really seen them in person for quite a while, which is sad. I'm hopeful that we can... You know, I can give my parents a hug again, but
amen.
My wife still has to go to the office with her job, so I was home with the kids, and they're normally at the Sun newsroom. We all gather together, and watch the Pulitzer results come in, and watch everybody else win, and watch the LA Times win, and watch the New York Times win, and watch the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal win. And this year, so they set up a Zoom call. I did get a call, a little heads up that said, you really need to be on the call. and so I said, oh, okay, that's a good sign.
You know, that's a good thing.
That was a call Mueller got when they made him county executive, right?
Well, so it was on the Zoom, and or it may not have been Zoom, it might have been Microsoft Teams or one of these other things. And it's coming across, and it says, the Pulitzer Prize for local reporting goes to the Baltimore Sun. And yeah, there was just sort of cheers across the Zoom call, and I think our publisher had a glass of champagne, and it was a big boost for a newsroom that's been through a lot, and glad that people saw how hard we still work, and how high quality the journalists who are still at the Sun are, honor us with this huge award.
Well, you should celebrate, you know, all the way through. And we have 426 mutual connections on LinkedIn. At some point, I'd like to say hello, break bread, and congratulate you personally. And when I do that, I'll deliver some Taharka eggnog ice cream because it's my favorite, even the leftover. So don't go to sleep on the eggnog. Hey, congratulations, really. And from Catonsville and McDonough in Baltimore, and we'll be watching you. And as Don says, you'll pop up on Bill Maher at some point, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, we'll see him.
Guys, thanks so much for having me on. And when this is all over, I'd love to get a Fade These Crab Cake with y'all.
There you go.
Luke, best wishes down there in D.C. And I know you'll make us all proud, and it's always been a pleasure to work with you. So thanks.
Great. Thanks so much.
Luke Broadwater, reporter at the Baltimore Sun, now moving to the New York Times and going to be doing some Congress stuff in a... We had a little healthy Holly conversation there, didn't we, in the future of Baltimore. Great stuff with Luke. Make sure you're following him out on Twitter. Don Mueller is a former Baltimore County executive, my dear friend, and one time 1982 Dundalk High guidance counselor, keeping me straight here with Baltimore Positive, waiting on election results, still trying to figure out what's going on in Washington, D.C., talking a lot about race and about crime and about policing and about education and about summer. I am Nestor. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We're keeping calm, we're staying local, and we're always Baltimore Positive.